So I'm calling this a nearly weaker than gravity bound on dark matter electromagnetism. But if anyone came along thinking this was going to be like a formal talk about the weaker than gravity conjecture, then you're going to be very disappointed. This is going to be dark matter astrophysics. So this is with Brian Feldstein and Luis O. Silva's group in Portugal. And they're simulators, and they simulate plasmas. And I'm gonna optimistically say this is archive number 1XXXXXXXX. So, okay, so the setup is what's the sort of minimal interaction we can imagine dark matter having? I would say the most minimal interaction is just a U1 prime. Right, it's the main interaction in the standard model, unbroken. Right, I'm not going to add any mass to this thing. So if I wanted to think about the minimal extension of dark matter in terms of self-interaction, this is the thing I would say. So it's incredibly simple. There's only two parameters: dark matter mass and some E prime coupling constant. Not only is it very sort of minimal, but maybe it has to be something to do with dark matter stability. Maybe dark matter being charged under this is why dark matter is stable. And it has incredibly rich physics. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. Maybe through kinetic mixing, you could have some way to observe it, which maybe I'll comment on at the end. But I'm going to think about the astrophysics of this dark matter self-interaction. Okay, so the first thing you might think of is just we're used to thinking about constraints on dark matter self-interactions from 2-to-2 dark matter particle scattering. And there's well-known the well-known bound from the Bullock cluster, probably the most well-known bound, says that the cross-section of dark matter self-scattering over its mass should be less than around 1 cm² per gram, I think is the number. This is for hard scattering, okay? This is not hard scattering, it's a long-range interaction. So in this case, we're thinking about...
this is a momentum transfer cluster.
Yeah, this is the...
For
hard scattering, it's well-defined. For a long-range interaction, you should define the energy transfer weighted cross-section. Yes?
If you convert the physics into the strength of interaction between two protons, it's about 20 to 100 times normal nuclear force.
That's right.
Makes it the strongest superforce in the universe.
This type of interaction? Now, of course, if dark matter is the light of the particle, not only does 1 over m goes up, but sigma typically goes up too. So for a lighter particle, this wouldn't have to be, I mean, for a heavy particle, that would be very hard.
So
a GeV particle like a proton, as you pointed out, with its strong interactions, it's just not quite at this level of self-interaction. If I lowered its mass by a factor of 10, it would be. If the proton was a factor of 10 lighter, then it would have a sufficiently big cross-section. The scattering for this type of interaction is very different. Okay, so you can think about Coulomb scattering. So Coulomb scattering is just 2-to-2 scattering with this type of interaction, right? Okay, and this has been considered in the literature. let's see, there's two papers. The first one was Mark Kaminkowski. Matt Buckley, I forget who else was on that paper, 2008. They looked at the two-to-two scattering bounds using calculating the Coulomb scattering cross-section. Okay, and as Maxime pointed out, you have to weight it by the energy transfer. So you have to calculate like the expectation value of sigma times delta E.
The energy transfer, momentum transfer, energy doesn't have to change.
Well, they argued that if the energy doesn't change, then you can't actually eject a dark matter particle from a halo.
Yes, yet the third type of cross-section. That's what I was wondering. This is what's called the transport cross-section. So momentum transfer.
I think they end up parametrically the same answer anyway, but yeah, I think they weighted it by energy because they wanted to say it has to have an energy kick to knock it out of the potential well. But again, they calculated this, and I'll get a little bit to the parametrics of this. So the bound comes from, say, the bullet cluster merger. So if the scattering time is, the scattering time should be greater than like the merger time in order to avoid this bound. If this cross section means that you typical particles scatter in the time that the two clouds pass through each other, then they would have been disrupted. And that time is of order a giga year, so like a tenth of the age of the universe. And you can also think about, so that was for the bullet cluster. You can also think about like survival of subhalos. So subhalos are just, you know, some lump of dark matter that's flying around through a bigger halo, and that could also scatter and be disrupted. And they have slightly different parametrics because they typically have lower velocity dispersions. And there you would want the scattering time, in that case, to be more like longer than the age of the universe. And everything I do is going to be twiddly because this is twiddly business. So let me just tell you the parametrics of what this Coulomb scattering bound is. So first of all, the Coulomb scattering cross section is roughly, it goes like the coupling to the fourth, and then a 1 over 4 pi m squared. So this is all just dimension analysis so far. And because it has a 1, this is Longage interaction, it goes like 1 over v to the fourth, where v is the relative velocity of the particles, if you like. And actually, so I'm going to give you this actually energy-weighted cross-section. So if you just do the pure cross-section, it's divergent. If you weight it by the energy transfer, then you get something that's only log divergent. And so there's some logarithm which gets cut off physically by some screening length.
That's the transfer.
Yeah, exactly. We want the age of the universe parametrically, let's think about this subhalo bound, over the scattering time. Right, so that's roughly equal to 1 over the scattering time, it's a scattering rate, it's like n sigma v, and then I multiply by T universe. Okay, and so the number density is just rho over m. Cross section is what I wrote up there. And the age of the universe is like 1 over Hubble. So I'm going to rewrite this in a funny way, and you'll see why. So the age of the universe is 1 over Hubble, which is roughly m Planck over the square root of the typical energy density in the universe, rho bar. Okay, and you'll see in a minute why I'm writing it like this. So this is roughly e to the fourth, and there's a rho, m Planck, over m cubed, v cubed, square root of rho bar. And that has to be roughly less than 1 in order to avoid the bound. Okay? Now I'm going to add in. I'm going to keep rewriting this. So I want to eliminate this V. I want to relate the V to what actually the V's are in these things. So I'm going to use the fact that for subhalos, they're typically virialized, right? So when two things merge, they're roughly moving at their gravitational virial velocity, and a subhalo inside a bigger halo has a sort of virial velocity. So that V cubed is roughly, V is roughly V virial, which is roughly G M over R, where M is the mass of the halo, the bigger halo, and R is the separation size. So these are big astrophysical sizes. And R is roughly just the mass over, R cubed is roughly the mass over the density, yes.
I have a question. So why for the subhalo is a virialized object, right? So it has decoupled from the expansion of the universe.
Yes.
So why don't you use the infall time of the subhalo as a dynamical time scale for this, and use the dynamical time scale for the universe? Because the potential could change within a dynamical time scale. Things move.
I mean, the infall time is maybe a factor of 10 shorter, right? So that's a weaker bound.
It's a weaker bound, yes. That's why.
But I'm saying, you know,
Yes, but
I'm saying it only needs to scatter once in the whole age of the universe. A typical particle only needs to scatter once in the whole age of the universe for a subhalo to be disrupted.
Within the subhalo.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Well, I
have a subhalo that's flying around a host halo.
A particle in the subhalo is scattered with one out in the overall halo.
Oh, in the overall halo.
That's the idea.
Yes.
That's
the yes. This little ball of subhalo is moving through this host, and it might scatter with the host halo particle.
I see.
Not
scattered with them. No, okay, good.
And this is all just to get some parametrics. Okay, so now I can use this to remove R, and I use this to remove V, and I can plug that in here, and what I get is that I won't go through the algebra, but I can write it like this. Charge per mass has to be less than 1 over M Planck times rho bar over rho, so the 1/8. Okay, so this is just the ratio of the universe's average dark matter density to the actual halo density. And then M halo over M dark matter particle to the 1/4. Okay, so if you ignored the first part, sorry, if you ignored these second parts, just that being less than that means the force is weaker than gravity. That's the definition of weaker than gravity. So how far is this bound from being weaker than gravity? So this is maybe like rho bar over rho is like 10 to the minus 5, so the 1 over 8. And that is like mass of, say, the Milky Way would be 10 to the 67 GeV of M to the 1/4. So you can see that this big factor is meaning we're a long way from being weak in gravity. Okay. So let me just draw like an exclusion plot. Maybe I'll draw that over here.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's draw. I'll do that. So let's draw the coupling E prime. You can all see this, okay?
Fine.
Oh, it's shiny? Too shiny?
It's fine.
But I have so much space. Why not? I just. Okay. It hasn't caught up with me. So here's E prime, and there's, let's say, 1. And let me have my dark matter mass range go from. I'm going to pick EV up to M Planck, just because. Okay, so if I want to draw this exclusion, sorry, what am I doing? Where did I put my? I drew that wrong. Let's see. got to be right. Okay. This is what I wanted to do. Sorry. Up to like 10 TeV. And this is like 10 to the minus 10. Okay, so that seems like a strong bound for a super light dark matter. And then coupling has to be weaker than about 1 at 10 TeV. Okay. So that's what you get if you consider 2-to-2 particle scattering. And what I want to do is zoom way out on this. Okay, I'm going to zoom way out till this is, I'm going to use 10 to the minus 28 there, and then Planck here instead of 10 TeV. And that thing that I just drew now becomes like this. And now I'm going to draw the strength of gravity, which is like this. Okay, so I want to try and improve the bound from this to somewhere close to this. Okay, and that's where all the plasma physics comes in. So let me switch to some slides now. Here's the clue why we might need to go beyond Coulomb scattering. So this is a supernova remnant, right? So there's a supernova that's exploded, and this like shell of material has expanded outwards, like very fast through space. And as it goes, it's like all this matter that's been blasted out, and it like picks up interstellar gas. Right, so a space, there's about, like in this interstellar space, there's about 1 GV per centimeter cubed, just like ambient matter. And it gets like picked up and heated up by this shock wave that's traveling outwards. And that's why it glows in, and there's big magnetic fields in there. So this is a false color image with like X-ray and synchrotron radiation. So this shell is expanding outwards. It makes sense if you think about, you know, there's an explosion, the shock wave expands out sort of through air, it makes sense. But actually, when you think about the fact that this is empty space, and this is actually extremely sparse, and the size of the shock front is about 0.04 parsecs, and then you think about how does the shock front actually pick up particles? In the air, there'd just be stuff bouncing around, right? But now the proton scattering length from Coulomb scattering is about what I drew here. So there's no way that a typical proton can get like picked up by this shock front by Coulomb scattering. And the answer is that there's all sorts of incredibly complicated collective plasma effects which are acting much more effectively than Coulomb scattering. So that's going to be the same effects that I'm going to talk about for dark matter. So obviously, you know, this is astrophysics. This stuff is incredibly well known. And everything I'm going to tell you is largely well known by some people. Just it wasn't well known by me, and I don't think it's well known by most particle physicists. I'll tell you a bit about how plasma physics works at a sort of pedagogical way. So apologies if you already know all about plasma physics. You might be bored. Okay. So what we have is a plasma of electrically charged particles. Okay, it's the same in the dark matter case as in the shock front. There's no particle collisions. This is called the collisionless plasma regime. So it's like, in a way, it's totally textbook physics, but actually because it gets so complicated that you have to simulate, and it's still like an active area of simulation research, and it's like super complicated dynamics. So the reason this is so complicated and the reason it's so rich is because of plasma instabilities. And I'll tell you a little bit about what plasma instabilities are. So first of all, let's back off from plasma instabilities and just talk about like a single cold plasma. So it's a bunch of plus and minus particles that never scatter off each other with Coulomb scattering. This thing can have plasma waves, and this is well known. So plasma oscillations. And a plasma oscillation, let's see if this works.
So you said they never scatter off of each other in
yes.
Coulomb interactions? So how are they interacting with each other? Just through average field?
And how they're interacting is what I'm going to show you now, right? So ask me the question again in 5 minutes if you don't understand. But
maybe I should understand what the ground is like. What are we turning on and off?
So perhaps I should say, so this fields, we're going to turn on what we're doing is instead of two-to-two scattering, we're doing end-to-end scattering involving like coherent field configurations, right?
Yeah.
Which is something you don't see in two-to-two scattering. So you can think of this as the limit of end-to-end scattering, where n is parametrically all of the particles.
Yeah.
So, which of course allows you to have use much weaker couplings than if you're just doing two-to-two scattering. Okay, so this is a plasma oscillation, which is just like there's plus and minus particles, and they all like shift back and forth a bit, right? So none of the particles are actually moving to one side or the other. They just oscillate back and forth a bit like a water wave, but you can see that you get like plus charged regions and minus charged regions which have wave fronts which move along. So this is the same thing. Let's see if this works. This is the same thing, but you just saw in the plasma rest frame. But you can see these waves moving. So let's shift to the frame of those waves. So now all of the particles are like streaming to the left. But on top of that, they have these little oscillations from left to right, so that you can see you have like overdense and underdense, like minus and plus regions that are staying in the same place. Okay. So this is known to be a stable configuration. Obviously, there's an E field here, right? I have minus and plus charge regions, so I have this E field that points like back and forth, back and forth. You can think of it like it's like a steady state. So these things are bunched. That generates this E field. The E field, if I'm a plus particle, as I go this way, I get accelerated quickly through the orange region. So I don't spend much time in that orange region, and I get slowed down as I head into this blue region. So I actually spend more time in the blue region. So it's a steady state where the bunching perpetuates itself. And this can live forever in a perfect dispersion, in this perfect cold plasma. Okay, so this is like the sort of most baby case for plasmas. And now let's do something where we take what we just saw, which is that this thing, and now we can do the same, but with the plasmas moving in the opposite direction. Okay, and these are both, either of them on their own is a steady state. Okay, it's just a plasma, it's a standard plasma oscillation, but they have the same E field configuration, right? And I can add them on top of each other. So I can imagine adding them on top of each other. So now I have dark matter particles of one type, you know, from one group streaming one way, or from another group streaming the other way. And I get to add up those E fields, right? So I have twice the E field I had before.
Does it matter if the particles are the same mass?
Good. Let me think about the question in a second. Let me finish what I was going to say. You've maybe seen it already, but now I have. I can think about, you know, what was the steady state before. Now I've doubled the E field, right? So now, my bunching has created twice as much E field, and so the E field causes twice as much bunching, and it's like a unsteady, it's like a cycle which is going to exponentially grow.
That basically is standing. It looks like on the right.
So on the left.
Like there are two waves coming together. It looks like the blue and orange regions are basically the same all the time. So that's why I say.
So on the left, the blue and orange regions are basically the same, and this is like a standing wave.
So why isn't the right hand one like that?
I'm claiming that for the left, for the single plasma, it's all moving in one direction or the other. This is just a normal plasma oscillation, which is a standing wave. It's stable, just lasts forever. And now I'm adding these two together. I'm just arguing that for the same amount of like bunching, I've doubled the E field. So what was stable can no longer be stable, because the E field accelerates things twice as much as before. So this is, I mean, the way I've animated it here looks like a standing wave, but actually what really happens is this, right? You start off putting in a little perturbation, and then it exponentially grows. This is the best cartoon explanation of why, but there are plasma instabilities, and this is that I could come up with. And so this is what's called a longitudinal plasma instability, because obviously these are longitudinal waves, and there's an exponential growth time for this. And of course, you can just do the math, and this is something that you can say the the density of each species is like uniform plus a little perturbation, and you can do it all on pen and paper, and you can see the full results analytically. So this is something you can do analytically. It's very nice.
This was sort of asked before, but I'm still a bit confused about the ground rules. Is each charged particle feeling the mean field of everybody
yes.
else?
Yes, each charged particle is feeling the mean field. That's right. That's right. So the answer is going to be, I'm going to start up with, I have a situation where any little perturbation from perfect uniformity is going to be like it's going to grow exponentially because these modes are, this plasma, the situation where I have two plasmas streaming through each other is unstable. A single plasma on its own is fine, two streaming through each other, it wants to evolve these modes with bunching and with net charge and with fields, it runs away, and then at some point you get to a nonlinear regime. Okay, and when you get to the nonlinear regime, you have to simulate because you can't solve it analytically. So actually this is the longitudinal instability. Seemingly the even more important one is a transverse instability, and I didn't make a cartoon for that. So let me just try and sketch how that works. So the transverse one is like I have plus, let's say I have plus and minus particles, all moving that way. And then the same on the other side, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. But let's say I've slightly perturbed it so that the minuses are slightly lower than the pluses, right? So that I have like a, the minuses down there are like a, sorry, I should draw this one the wrong way around. Plus, minus. Okay, so on the lower one is minus moving to the right, and plus moving to the left. Okay, so that's a current moving to the left, and then slightly above it, there's minus moving to the right, and sorry, minus. Everything's moving, these things are moving through each other, but in terms of the actual current, right, the minus means that that's a minus current, that's a current moving to the left on top of another current moving to the left. So there's a net current moving to the left. So in the middle, let me draw J, okay? So it's going to be that way, that way, that way, that way. You see, so I have a slight separation of current, but I've put plus on top of minus. Right, so even though I drew these on the right and these on the left, I'm imagining these are sort of all the way through, so that this is net neutral. Right, there's always pluses on top of minuses, but they're moving in such a way that there's net current. Right.
Is it all neutral?
Sorry.
The current is all neutral. Which is plus and minus.
Oh, but I have the minus here, which is actually all the way through, and it's on top of a plus, which is so these minuses on top of these pluses. They're just moving in opposite directions. I didn't necessarily draw it very well. Okay,
you rubbed out the air. I'm very confused. You've got in the bottom thing, you've got plus going left. Now the minus on top of it, is it going the same direction of the plus or back?
So everything I drew on the left is moving to the right. Everything I drew on the right is moving to the left.
All right. So you got pluses and minus on top of each other going this way, and the others are going that way.
That's right.
Maybe I should do that.
But what's causing it to be neutral is the plus is moving to the right. Are neutralized with the minuses moving to the left, and vice versa. But I'm saying there's a separation of, like individually there's a separation so that it's, I could accentuate it like this. Okay, so if I just look at the species moving to the left, they're separated into sheets of plus, minus, plus, minus. And the ones moving to the right are separated also, but when I stack them on top of each other, it's net neutral. Net neutral, but there is current. So that current is, left, right, left, right, left, right. So this is a perturbation, and the idea is to show that this perturbation also grows exponentially fast. And you can just see, so I'll give you just like a cartoon argument for why that happens. So, right, so this is the current. Current creates net current creates net B field, okay, and B equals, curl B equals J, curl B equals J. Okay, I'm actually not gonna try and do the left-hand rule in my head, but there's a net B field which runs into the board. Right, let's, and I want the, if I, these may, I may have done these backwards, but let's say like this, okay? And whichever way it is, it causes these particles to bend, and it causes them to bend in a way which reinforces them to go into their separations, which I gave them already. So if I just had, of course, if I just had one of the plasmas on its own, these B fields would be there, but there would be an E field which would pull them back together. Now I've cancelled out the E field, and I just have the effect of the B field, which, and the effect of the B field is to reinforce these, this separation to plus minus plus minus. So this is a transverse instability, and it's actually and it ends up separating me into net neutral sheets of current. Okay, and it actually turns out to be more important. And in a minute I'll just parametrically go through the how fast these things grow. But okay, so the question is, what happens to dark matter halos, right? So I have these dark matter halos made of these collisionless plasmas. They fly, let's say, take the bullet cluster. They're flying through each other. There'll be some smaller little initial perturbations, at the very least, because they're made of, this stuff is made up of particles, so there's just Poisson fluctuations in number of particles. So there's some initial perturbations which will grow exponentially. At some point, they become order one perturbations. Then the evolution is nonlinear. And the question is, does this cause the halos to essentially sort of thermalize? And it, does this cause effective strong scattering of the dark matter?
Just on that, the perturbations are coming from Poisson things and particles. You also get damping of the perturbations just because they're restreaming on a small scale. Actually, right?
So yes, good. That's going to bring me up to something I'm going to talk about in a okay. Yes, internal dispersion does damp out these things, and I'll come back to that in a second. First, I just wanted to talk about the parametrics of these instabilities. Is everyone with me on like the concept of
the contour plasma is easier to develop?
Yes, and I'll be a bit more specific about that in a minute, yeah. So let me just do the parametrics of the growth rate in the perfectly cold case. So let's do the longitudinal instability. So I have particles separate, they're moving to the left and right, and they're separating into regions of plus and minus, right? From, if you remember my cartoon. Okay, so there's some charge over density, which I'll call sigma. Okay, that's my charge charge per unit area of this region, right? And the charge per unit area is just going to be E prime times the number density of particles times an amount which is times a small amount which is equal to how much they've separated, so delta x. So I'll say this is like how far the minus and plus particles are separated, right? So I've got some region where like the minus and plus particles are this is in a cartoon, the minus and plus particles are everywhere on top of each other except for in these overlaps. So here's the pluses and here's the minuses.
It's like a dipole.
Sorry? It's like a dipole, exactly. And except it's many of them back to back. Right,
is it important that it's a kind of periodic structure, or it has to be?
Well, in reality, of course, any structure will, in the linear regime, you just decompose it as a sum of the periodic structures. And then it doesn't matter. But then, of course, in the nonlinear regime, it's much more complicated. So this is the size of the charge over density, right? It's the volume. Well, so number density times this little distance here, and this little distance here is delta x. Okay, and the force on a particle, which is the E field I get is just equal to the charge density that's just normal, normally in M, the E field between the plus and minus regions. So x double dot is E prime over M times E, which equals E prime squared N over M times delta x. So this is a exponential growth equation, and this thing here is just known as the plasma frequency squared. So this is for a normal plasma, normal cold plasma, this would be the plasma frequency squared. But instead of being a frequency now, it is a exponential growth time. So the growth rate, gamma, for the longitudinal mode is of order of the plasma frequency. And I'm obviously there's like missing numerical factors, but this is correct parametrically. For the transverse ones, you can do something similar. Now I have plus and minus particles that are separating, like plus is going up and minus is going down. And I have a net current, which is E prime times times the number density times delta y over lambda times v. And let me say what this is. So delta y over lambda is just, let's say, my plasma mode wavelength is like separation lambda. So the separation between the different layers of plus minus current. Okay, so the amount of actual, like, the size of the fraction of them that have actually separated is delta y over lambda. So that this is a fraction that are actually contributed to the current times the number density times the velocity times the charge. And then we can just use this to say, okay, so curl B equals J, which means, and the curl is going to go like 1 over lambda, because I'm talking about just linear modes. So B is going to go like lambda J. So that's E prime N delta Y V. And then the acceleration goes like E prime over M times V cross B, right? So there's the force over the mass. And if I plug it in, I get omega plasma squared times V squared times delta Y. So again, it's like exponential growth. But this time, this V squared has appeared. So the growth rate of the transverse modes is roughly the plasma frequency times V, and V is just the relative velocity between the clouds. All right, that was a bit quick, but does anyone have any questions about what I'm, okay, so, but this result is important. I just wanted to sort of try and quickly show you parametrically how it comes about. It's very important, so there's two timescales. There's a much faster growth rate for the longitudinal mode, and a slower growth rate suppressed by the relative velocity for the transverse mode. And actually it's going to end up being that it seems that the transverse mode is probably the most important, but one of the, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but one of the questions that I wanted to answer and I don't have an answer to yet is, does the longitudinal mode on its own set a constraint, or do you have to rely on the transverse instability? And the bound you're going to get is going to be different by a factor of V, which is a hundredth or a thousandth. So this puts a big difference on like where the actual bound is going to end up. But I haven't answered that question yet.
So those movies you showed before were for a cold plasma, which I interpret to mean V must be quite small.
Yeah.
So is that true for this as well? I only believe this for small V.
Yeah, let me talk about that now.
But there are two V's, right? There's probably some
bulk motion at the end.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's true, of course. But
Which means this is of the streams, right?
So which is the V?
Yeah, this is the V of the streams. This is the relative velocity of the two clouds moving through each other. As you notice, like internal velocity dispersion is going to wash this out. And that's one of the important things. So our question was, we understand what happens in the linear regime fairly well and from analytics. What happens in the nonlinear regime? In the linear regime, at the linear level that you're working to, there is no actual slowdown. There is just charge separation, but there's no actual network done on the particles. There's no slowdown. So you can't just extrapolate the linear regime and say, oh, I'm going to extrapolate it and see how it slows down. In the linear regime, the net velocity doesn't slow down. Okay, so you have to go to the nonlinear regime, and you have to see what actually happens.
Where does the theory of structure formation go? There would be some initial very low velocity plasma, right? The lumps of which would collapse, right? And then at that point, I thought every particle gets its independent velocity. So in some sense, it heats up, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's still a picture here for you, right? Or not? Because you kind of assume that there is no relative motion between the particles in the streams and then the streams.
I did for this purpose, but in reality, there is lots of relative velocity, so I was
right. Because it's got to be as large as...
It's almost as large, exactly. Right. So this is what I was just getting to. So let me discuss that in a second. So the question is, what happens in the nonlinear regime? Okay, and does it cause... like these halos that are moving through each other. What's that? Are you Skyping? Yeah, okay.
Keep going. It's a commercial.
So our expectation is that these instabilities are they're very powerful. They do cause it's what we understand causes supernova shockwave remnants to actually exist. After all, it's like a powerful effect, and we sort of expected it from what we had read to work effectively to slow down dark matter plasmas. But we wanted to simulate to actually know for sure.
We have examples of finite gas in the universe hitting each other in these ways. And...
Well, that is the supernova remnant I just told you about is like the sort of most classical example as far as I can tell. This is the context in which most of the simulations are done, right? So our approach was we wanted to see the result in simulation because we didn't, trust the analytics. The obvious question is: isn't the answer sort of already known from the years of simulation? And it seemed that the answer is no. The result isn't known, and there's a reason, which is that people don't like to simulate this regime. And this regime that we're talking about is the very non-relativistic regime. Right, so for the Bullock cluster, the relative velocity is about 1/100th of the speed of light, and for say a subhalo in the Milky Way, it's like 1/1000th of the speed of light. That factor of 100 or 1,000 is actually a big hierarchy that enters into a simulation and makes a simulation very difficult. So people haven't really simulated that this type of scenario, and it's actually slightly difficult. But we wanted to simulate. I'll tell you why we wanted to simulate. There's some physics answers, and there's actually also a true answer. I'll start with I'll start with the true answer number one. In this Kaminkowski paper that I mentioned at the beginning, we started working on this, and then we thought no one had realized this. Then we realized, of course, Mark Kaminkowski knows plasma physics, and he knew this. And actually, so in their paper, there's a short section where they discussed this sort of thing. And they didn't put the result on their money plot, which is why we didn't notice originally. They were very cautious about it. They were like, if these effects rule out dark matter, then there's this very strong bound. So we thought, okay, well, we want to do this better and actually say, look, we think there's this bound. So we wanted to simulate more than just prognosticate. So the fact that we were very scooped in that regard was one reason we wanted to simulate. But there's also physics reasons we wanted to simulate. So one is this velocity dispersion. Okay, what's the effect of this velocity dispersion? The more internal velocity dispersion there is, the smaller the growth rate. And so And actually, for the longitudinal mode, there's a shutoff. So these two plots, this is a plot of velocity against fraction of particles. So these two lumps, these are two lumps, one lump going to the left and one lump going to the right on top of each other, and they have some internal velocity spread. Okay, so this is a case where they're sufficiently cold that these parametrics hold and this is unstable. Okay, and this is a case where they're sufficiently hot that this longitudinal instability has completely disappeared. So this case, even though there are two distinct sort of groups of dark matter particles, their internal velocity is enough that there's no longitudinal instability. And actually, as Maxine was pointing out, in, say, merging halos, the internal velocity dispersion is similar to, it's comparable to the relative velocity. And people don't really know for the bulk cluster, say, but there have been simulations that people have done that suggest the internal velocity dispersion is sort of in the ballpark of a third of the relative velocity. Okay? And the shutoff happens at 38%. So it's sort of.
I learned that bullet cluster has, for whatever big reasons, a very large relative velocity.
Oh, so the bullet cluster is an exceptional.
Right. That this is like one out of many million exceptions in the.
Oh, really?
Very costly.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, yeah.
Exceptional how?
But it's too fast going at each other, right?
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay, so the bullet cluster may be the coldest case then. Okay, and even other cases may be hotter. So with the bullet cluster, it's like, it's astrophysics, it's not really known what the internal velocity dispersion is, but it's close enough that you worry, at least the longitudinal mode might have shut off. And with the transverse mode, it's a bit less clear. It's easy to show analytically that the longitudinal mode shuts off, and the transverse mode doesn't have a clear cutoff point like this. So we wanted to see, does the internal velocity dispersion cause the slowdown, cause this interaction to not happen? That was one problem. Another reason to simulate is, as I mentioned, if the transverse instability stops it, but the longitudinal one doesn't, or if it's the longitudinal one that stops it, that's a factor of 100 or 1,000 in where the bound is, and we wanted to understand where the bound really is. Also, we'd like to understand. I'd like to understand. Is the bound coming from the bullet cluster? Is it coming from subhalos like dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way? The parametrics are quite different. I don't have an answer to that. And one reason is that it's hard to simulate things in the regime that we're actually interested in. Is he carrying a dog?
He killed it.
Yeah,
he killed it.
Plastic box. Kind of doesn't
So let me tell you the third reason we want to simulate, which is that obviously it's nice. Ruling out a huge parameter space is a bit of a downer, and it'd be nice to say, okay, on the edge of the ruled out region, there's like a region where maybe there's some signature that you can look for. It's always nice to have like a positive angle.
I like saturating this cross section, right?
Yeah, it's interesting though, because for the cusps, it happens in small dense regions. This likes to happen in big fast things, right? So the parametrics are quite different, and it wouldn't necessarily wash out cusps. It's not clear. It's possible, for example, that the transverse instability sort of sets a bound. But the longitudinal instability has some level of effect, for couplings a factor of 100 smaller, which we're not able to rule out yet, but because the astrophysics is too messy, but maybe is actually having some observational effect. That's just a little possibility that I wanted to mention, but I don't have any clear way to, suggest looking for that. As I said, existing simulations don't really look in the regimes we want, which is slow particles. We'd also like to look at like one cloud is much denser than the other, which would sort of represent the subhalo inside the host halo. That's actually hard to simulate too, and we didn't manage to get our people to simulate that. People don't include gravity. We didn't include gravity, but really, you know, the reason there's this big internal velocity dispersion is because there's gravitational interaction, like holding these things together, right? So really, to simulate it properly, including the velocity dispersion, you should put in gravity to allow it to have a velocity dispersion and still be bound. What we did was we just, there's no gravity, we give an initial velocity dispersion. This will, of course, that would just let it spread out over time, right? So it's sort of a hack, and it doesn't really, you know, represent the true thing. But
back to Mina's question, does it matter that the what the mass ratio of positive and negative species is?
Oh, good. Yes. Yeah, so if you make one species much lighter, like in standard model, then obviously it's the lighter one that does all the legwork, doing the instability, and it's the heavier one that carries all the momentum. So the parametrics are slightly different, but not like, you know, not sort of morally different, if you know what I mean. and also most of the simulations are 2D, and we wanted 3D. That ended up being a sticking point too. These simulations are expensive, like, you know, dollar expensive, because you have to run them on these supercomputer clusters. So. Let me show you some. Let me just mention quickly something about the simulations. There's these well-defined equations, right? I have the fluids of plus minus particles with velocity, in phase space of in a phase space of position and velocity, and I have a density in that space. Okay, and these are the formal equations just governing it. You don't have to look at them too long, but they're just Maxwell's equations plus the Lorentz force equations. One important thing is that this applies to like electrons and positrons, but also the exact same equations apply to dark matter. And the only difference is, you know, if E prime is different from E, and if M dark matter is different from M electron, I can totally rescale it out, and I can use exactly the same simulation results. I just have to rescale what I'm applying it to. And in fact, the only thing that's important is my measuring stick is omega plasma for my time unit, and V times omega plasma for my distance unit, right? So if I have a simulation that is, say, 100 of those distance units long, that applies to electrons that are 100 units long in the electron units, or dark matter for a dark matter cloud that's 100 units long in the dark matter units. So it's exactly the same types of simulation and apply to the dark matter. I just have to, you know, convert. Yeah.
Yeah, what is the key thing here that separates you from the million plasma physics, you know, fusion power simulations that they do?
So the key thing is, one, the non-relativistic. I mean, we're looking at two clouds moving through each other non-relativistically.
Right.
And we're looking to ask, do they slow down? No one had done that. People have done this with relativistic plasmas. People have done this in some non-relativistic case with very high background B field, which changes things too, because in these supernova remnants, there's usually very large background B fields.
I'm thinking just like not astrophysics, like laboratory.
And people simulate it for laboratory reasons too.
Yeah.
I can't tell you exactly why people hadn't done this, but I mean, this is, you know, the plasma people told us this hasn't been done, but we think we can do it, right? And so,
what's F?
Sorry.
What's the definition?
And, sorry, F is the phase space density of dark matter. So, as a function of real space and velocity and time, so it's the full phase space. How many dark matter particles are there with those properties for both plus and minus charged particles? So this is what goes into the simulations, and the simulations are like established code for real standard model particles, but they just directly apply to dark matter. And hey, this is the results of some simulations. So this is a, so here we have like two clouds of dark matter that was, you know, starting like this and like this, and they're just at time zero, they're both moving into each other like this. So they're going to start to overlap. And these plots are showing the evolution of the fields. So so the longitudinal mode that I mentioned gives you these E fields, which point, you know, side to side. And the transverse mode gives you these B fields, which point sort of into the plane. Right, so let me just, you can look at this again. So what you have is like a, you can see that there's like a shock front, or two shock fronts, where the merged region is expanding outwards. And what happens is that because of the longitudinal mode develops fastest, you can see that like the longitudinal, the region where these E fields are happening are further out than the region where the B field are happening. Because in that region, the plasmas have just merged, and the E field has developed, and the B field hasn't developed yet. But then later on, what happens is this dies down in the middle, which we attribute to having heated up the dark matter in there to the point where that instability saturates and turns off, and then that longitudinal instability is no longer.
Can you explain a bit? What density profile of these plasmas is? Are you assuming that they're similar, or is it just uniform?
So the density profile is two uniform things.
But you start moving to it.
Which you start moving through each other at time t, and they're perfectly cold in this situation, in this simulation.
So they're not moving, the relative velocity is just the two plasmas going like this.
So it's yes. Not, it's not two blocks, it's two
uniforms everywhere. Blocks. And then you two sheets that are
two semi infinite regions.
Good.
Yes, good. With just one front, with a frontier, which is a plane.
Okay, there's a frontier. There's
so it's two planes doing this.
Yeah.
Two planes doing this.
It's two planes. So everywhere that side of the room is one species and it's all moving towards me. Everywhere on that side is another species and it's all moving towards me. And then there's a plane in the room which is the boundary between them. Okay, at time zero.
What side is it? One plus, one minus?
No. And each side is net neutral. So it has the same amount of plus and minus. And it's perfectly net neutral up to small fluctuations, which in this case are numerical. Right. So in fact, what's the inhomogeneity that's set is the seed of the what we see? In this case, it's numerical, like error, which is
two different species of equal mass particles.
Yeah, so they're identical. There's plus species that are moving one way, and there's plus species moving the other way that are identical. But you can track them separately, obviously, in the simulation.
So the seed perturbation is really small. Right?
Yeah. So in real life, you might think it would be, you know, if you assume just Poisson fluctuations of the dark matter, it's much smaller than you can ever put into the simulation. So, you know, the seed perturbations are relatively large in the numerical case. You have these perfectly cold things which start to move through each other. The longitudinal mode develops like first, but then saturates, and you have this sort of region where there's an internal velocity dispersion here, which is true, like we check that. So this is sort of heated up to the point where the longitudinal mode is turned off. But then the B field is developing in that region because of this transverse mode, and you can see this development of these like sheets of, and this is showing the net B field, which sort of corresponds to these sheets of, you know, current flowing one way, current flowing the other way, and then there's this funny region in the middle, which is where you know, the ultimate evolution of what happens to these sheets is sort of the complicated question. This is 2D, and 3D it'd actually be like filaments of dark matter, right? It's not sheets, it's actually breaks into filaments with B field wrapping around them. And these filaments are, filaments of current, and they start to sort of interact with each other. And the rough picture is like, if I have two wires with current in the same direction, there's this force that pulls them together. If I have two filaments of current, they sort of get merged. They get attracted to each other and sort of merge. So the picture is I go from, and it's hard to see in these 2D simulations, but you first you form the sort of smallest filaments, and then they start to merge. And in the regions that started to go sort of longer ago in time, the filaments should have merged to become bigger. But ultimately what happens, and what you're sort of seeing in here, is that these things seem to have sort of essentially thermalized in the middle. This is the same simulation, but now looking at the number density of particles. So there's the left moving particles and the right moving particles. And you can see that they just sort of seem to sort of, if you look at the top two plots, that they've both sort of ended up in just blobs in the middle, sort of thermalized in this case. And this is the E and B fields. You can see that like these big blue peaks are like the sort of front of where the merger is just, you know, first, you know, it's the edge of the merger region, and big B fields have developed. And in the middle, it's died down, and it's sort of thermalized. So this is the, you know, in as much as you can say this, what we simulated, is the same as the dark matter case, you can say that it's thermalized. And the distance scale, you know, you can say that you can, and in this case, they were moving into each other at a speed of only a fifth of the speed of light. Okay, so it's not quite the real physics, you know, the real astrophysics case. And it's these two semi-infinite blobs. There's no initial velocity dispersion. There's all these things about it that are not quite the real astrophysical situation. But in this case, you can say it was the transverse modes that really caused these things to stop. And this is a plot of, as a function of time, this is a different simulation where they're actually moving at a tenth of the speed of light relative to each other. So this is the speed of just the particles that start moving to the right. And this is averaged over the whole, all of those particles, right? All of the particles that are initially moving to the right. And you can see their average speed is just slowing down and it sort of heads towards zero. And this is consistent with this being caused by the transverse instability. Okay. So we have this picture that things start to move through each other. This longitudinal instability, if they're sufficiently hot, will never happen, will never turn on. If they're sufficiently cold, it will turn on and it will start to actually heat up the particles until the point where they have a velocity dispersion that shuts off that instability. Okay. And then what happens is on a slower time scale, the transverse instability develops with these sheets or filaments of current. And then those currents start to merge and it sort of heats up the particles too, and you end up with just a totally thermalized situation where essentially the dark matter has completely scattered and stopped still.
Okay, so if I were to just look at the density profile of the thing, initially you have two blobs that come together, and they...
Yeah, so you can see this is before it starts, and they're just two, they're uniform blobs. One is on the left and one is on the right.
And they just get stuck in the middle. This is what you're
saying.
And
they just get stuck in the middle.
Do you?
Okay. No, I don't have any.
Do you ever expect radiative loss, energy losses to be?
Good. No, you don't. And you can understand that from radiative losses in the Feynman diagram has an extra extra E. So we're talking about really small E's. And actually, so let me get to what E's we're actually talking about. Oh, and I'm over time, right? So let me just wrap up. Okay. So let me just. This is the most important bit, so let me do this at least, and then I'll basically be done. So I want to talk about, so I got the parametrics for the turn-on time for these instabilities. So now let me do the parametrics for where the bound would be. Okay, so let's say that I want... the age of the universe times the growth rate to be less than around, right? So if this was one, then that's one, you know, growth time in the age of the universe. But actually, you would imagine these things may start very homogeneous, right? So actually, if you use the fact that, if you assume the initial seed in homogeneity is purely from Poisson fluctuations, then you can see that actually what you need is to grow by some large number of, you know, E folds. And that large number is of order 100.
Could this be even erased when the collapse happens on derealization? Because this is a fast process.
Is it erased?
Well, we are talking about the perturbations on the small scale. Right? Mm-hmm. No, it's not a rising size perturbations.
Let's see. So it is.
You want the perturbations in plus and minus charges.
Yeah. Good. So okay. So the plasma frequency, which sets this length scale. So 1 over the plasma frequency is proportional to the mass over the charge. So right on the edge of the bound, which is where I'm making the charge as small as possible and the mass as big as possible, is where this length scale is as big as possible. And the edge of the bound is going to be where this length scale is an astrophysical size, comparable to the sizes of these objects. And the time scale is going to be comparable to the dynamical crossing time of these objects. So actually, we're not talking about small scales on the edge of the bound. So right on the edge of the bound, you want to make sure that it's had enough time to grow from something, you know, with only tiny fluctuations. And so you need to grow exponential amount, and you're growing exponentially fast. So there's a large log. This number 100 here is a large log that you can, you know, is actually a slowly varying function of what the mass of the dark matter particle is, if you just assume Poisson fluctuations. But it's about 100. Okay, and the universe time again is 1 over Hubble, which is roughly Planck mass over square root of the average universe density. And then for the longitudinal mode, it's about actually 0.3, the growth rate is about 0.3 plasma frequencies. And for the transverse mode, it's omega plasma times V. So let's start with the longitudinal mode. So I need is for the longitudinal one, I need omega plasma to be less than around, so there's this factor of I multiply by 3 to get rid of that, and I get 300, and then a root rho bar over, and I'm going to switch to Planck mass from reduced Planck mass to compare with gravity. So there's a root 8 pi, which isn't very important. But when I then plug in, right, what is omega plasma? I get E over m must be less than around 10 to the 3 times the square root of rho bar over rho. So rho bar is like the universe's average density, and rho is actually like the object's density, times 1 over m Planck. And numerically, rho bar is over rho is like 10 to the minus 5. So the square root of this is similar to this factor there. So that's of order 1 over m Planck. So this says that the longitudinal mode will be important parametrically if this new U1 prime interaction is parametrically stronger than gravity. And for you to be sure that it will never be important, it has to be parametrically weaker than gravity. So that's obviously very different from the Coulomb scattering case. You can do the same for the transverse mode. If you're talking about the bullet cluster, as I said, the speed is about, you know, it's slower to turn on, so the bound is weaker. For the transverse mode, it's, you know, it's weaker by maybe a factor of 100 or 1,000, depending on which astrophysical situation you're turning on. So there we're talking about something which is sort of somewhere, the bound is going to be sort of somewhere in that region. And exactly where it is one of the things that I wanted to, you know, have a clear answer about, but don't really yet. So let's see. My conclusion is, so for this type of interaction, which is very minimal, clearly these plasma instabilities are going to be the dominant thing that affects the astrophysics of this of dark matter in terms of self-interaction. It's possible that the bound is that dark matter, this interaction must be weaker than gravity. If you take this scaling here, which means you've allowed it the whole universe time to grow, and you're assuming the longitudinal mode actually does exclude it, which The simulations don't totally seem to indicate yet, but it's difficult to really be sure about that. And if you look at the transverse instability, also called the filamentation instability, then the bound is a bit weaker than gravity. So that's what I've sort of illustrated here. The hard thing is comparing this to like what's, you know, the real situation. We wanted to do like situations which were slower, but that's just numerically hard because it means you have a hierarchy of length scales that you have to deal with. We wanted to also do the case where one halo is much denser than the other. That also introduces a hierarchy of scales, and
the bullet cluster physically is that.
So with the bullet cluster, it's not really certain, but a range that's been estimated is that so you have the smaller one that moved to the bigger one. And as we've seen it, it's sort of gone like this, but we don't know if it's passed through the middle or if it's sort of passed through the edge. And there's a factor of, you know, 10 in the estimates that were made. So they might have moved through a similar density region, or it might have moved through a larger region that's a factor of 10 less dense. And we haven't simulated that. Obviously, for like a dwarf,
yeah,
a subhalo is denser and it has a low velocity dispersion. You know, the goal would be really, you know, better simulations. By the way, Tom Abell at Stanford is, you know, also simulates these things, has recently started simulating plasmas and has a different method which is more efficient. I mean, I threw that in there because I talked to him about it. Yeah, I talked to him about it. He was very interested, like, in principle. But it would be nice to actually relate this better to the astrophysics situations, and it would be nice to include gravity. And it's, you know, that's the challenge. So I don't know, you can give me your thoughts on where how to package this up and sell it.
So if you
introduce
a small kinetic mixing, you raise the bounds. Oh, good.
So the first observation is obviously that the dark matter carries way more energy density than normal matter. So it's not that the normal matter would erase the dark matter, it's that the dark matter would start to probably do funny things to the plasmas that we see potentially, right?
You can forget about, I mean, in some limit, right?
Yeah,
this is like a small charge times a small charge, and here you have.
I mean, in the limit that, I mean, I thought about this because that was the case we started thinking about before we realized that actually just the self-interactions were important. But if the standard model, like fields, are strong enough to affect the dark matter, right, then they don't actually have enough, you know, energy in them to actually, you know, if they try to move the dark matter, they will in fact just be moved by the dark matter, right?
Maybe it will introduce dynamic relaxation, so I'm not sure.
Yes, you could.
Plasma frequency is still very good.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Dissipation. I don't know. Maybe it's also constraint. Because if you can constrain or kill newly charged dark matter, it would be also very nice. Right?
Well, nice or terrible, depending on your outlook. But yes, that was how we started on this.
Any model of that is resolutely, I think it's nice.
The way we started on this work was thinking about miniaturized dark matter, and we sort of, before we realized that there were these plasma instabilities, what we seemed to be finding was that because there's so much more dark matter, you can essentially think about, obviously a plasma mass is not the same as the actual physical mass, but if you just think about it like that, you know, to help you as a cartoon, to help you think about it, then what you have is a relatively large, because the dark matter density is so large, it creates a plasma mass for whatever it couples to, right? And then the photon will be the other thing, right? So then, in fact, the correct basis to think about the photon will be the thing that doesn't couple to dark matter. And as far as we could tell, that seemed to be true when you actually follow through, you know, the plasma equations. But it's a little tricky to really get some part of it. Yeah, I mean, there is some energy transfer from one to the other as long as there's some dissipation in the standard model, right? But yeah, I don't have a clean answer.
There's another merging clusters. Four people, 520, to train wreck cluster. And
train
wreck. Data published as a physical trainer. But there are, what you do is you have data left for the convergence, the latent convergence, a capital there. And in the center of the hot plasma of this object, we've seen a large dark matter basically.
Now you can this theory, right?
This is very, very controversial. And in order to explain how you can get dark matter in the Chandra X-ray plasma, we need self-interactive dark matter of order 1 cm² per gram or more. You want to glue it.
Well, he has glued it with much, much smaller cross sections, right? Just to glue it due to the coherence.
Well, the thing is that you don't see this in the bullet plasma. There is no dark matter people.
So, I mean, what are the astrophysical uncertainties in this observation? Right. I mean, how much should I believe those results, or should I worry that it's just some, you know, the lensing is very difficult to do correctly, and that's...
Well, the papers for Chi and Adavi are twice claimed that they've seen this.
Seeing, do other people agree with them?
So I think I should believe them.
Are the lensing...
Well, Chloe now claimed earlier that they don't see it, but they've changed their ways.
Oh, okay.
So the other issue is last week we had a talk as to why you need self-interacting dark matter to solve the custody problems of tissue process galaxies. So, only the custody and other problems. Absolutely. So I guess how does this affect?
Yeah, this is the parameters of this are quite different. So in the custody problem, you can just have a very dense region. I have these cold, dense regions, and for normal, like hard scattering, those will be washed out by self-interactions faster than the, you know, than in the outer regions. So it removes the cusp without affecting, like, the large-scale structure. And in this, it might be the opposite, because these type of instabilities need, you know, the edge of the bound is where it's taking, like, you know, sort of a large fraction of the sort of wavelength of the mode that's growing is a large fraction of the size of the actual object. Let's say 10% or something. So it actually needs big objects in order to grow, and small objects, it has less time to grow. So that's one thing. And also in a thermal spherically symmetric distribution, nothing happens, right? This instability is only there for say counter streaming, or if I distort the velocity distribution away from spherically symmetric, then I get some instability potentially. But in a cusp, maybe it's a high density region, but the velocity dispersion is spherically symmetric, and actually there would be no instability in this case. So I don't think this naturally is a way to solve the cusp problem. In as much as it's a problem,
it doesn't solve. Problem.
Yeah, I'm saying it does not. Doesn't. I haven't studied. I don't know the, like, for definite the answer, but I think it does not solve that problem.
3 weeks ago, my calibration, it's claiming this solves all the problems.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people think. Some astrophysicists think there's no problem, anyway. But you know, I'm not expert enough to say whether there is a problem or not.
Well, it doesn't fit the data.
Right, but some people say, oh, well, as soon as you include baryons and supernova feedback.
There's that's a very separate
topic for me. So. Yeah, see, it seems to be controversial, and I don't want to weigh in on it because I don't know enough. But.
Well, Jeremy's here until the end of the week, so there's a lot more time for discussion. Let's thank Jeremy.